Welcome back, dear students. Welcome back. In this third presentation for stocks, we will take a look at transactions and what kind of costs are associated with those transactions, and then turn our attention to market indexes, indices, averages, benchmarks that we use to determine how well the stock market as a whole is doing. Let's start on slide number 34 with a quick definition of bull market versus bear market. Now, you've probably already heard the stories, maybe, maybe not. A bull market is when the stock market's going up. And according to the book, they are favorable markets normally associated with rising prices, investor optimism, economic recovery, and government stimulus. Whereas a bear market is an unfavorable market normally associated with falling prices, investor pessimism, economic slowdown, and government restraint. Well, if the government does it right, they're supposed to be stimulating when the bear market hits, assuming it was created by a recession. And when there's a bull market, the government should be more restrained. But that's not how it works in real life, is it? No, the government never does things that they're supposed to do. Where did the terms come from? Well, you will hear people say that bulls charge ahead, that they attack by throwing their opponents up into the air, hence, you know, up, up, up. Bears, on the other hand, are more reclusive, and when they attack, they paw down their opponents. They knock them down with their paws. But that's not really where the terms come from. Really, nobody knows. But supposedly, the term bear market came from people who used to go out and hunt for bear skins in the 19th century. And I don't understand the saying, don't sell the bear skin before the bear is caught. But it has something to do with why bear markets are called bear markets. For those of you who are excited and interested in word etymology, have at it. Slide number 35. There are four major types of stock transactions. Actually, there are more, but these are the four we want to take a look at. But really, as far as I'm concerned, the only one you should use is the first one, the market order. Buy or sell at the current price. Because if you want to buy it, buy it. If you want to sell it, sell it. That's my humble opinion. But no, there are other ways you can do it. You can say, look, I will buy or I will sell, but I'm going to set a price that I will buy at or sell at. If it doesn't go below that price or hit that price, then I'm not buying. You know, it's 25, I don't want to buy it unless it hits 22. So you can put a limit order such that if it goes down to 22, you will buy. And the same thing is true on the upside. If it goes up to 28 or 29, you will sell. Now, what's the difference with the stop loss and stop limit? They're very similar. But there's just a few little nuances. A stop loss order says that you will buy or sell at the current price once the trigger point is reached. So you say, as soon as it hits 22, I will buy, or I will sell, or whatever. But you don't know what price you're going to get. It becomes a market order. Whereas a stop limit is similar to a limit in that, yes, once the trigger is reached, it now becomes a limit order. So the differences are very subtle. And although you can use limit orders to buy or sell at a price you want, and stop loss, stop limit orders to lock in profits or protect against losses, remember that they trigger automatically. If for some reason you change your mind, it's often too late to cancel the order. By the time you've gotten to the PC or the Mac or your cell phone and tried to cancel the stop loss order, it's too late. The market's moving too darn fast for you. And here is a graph, a table from your book that describes them in more detail. The most important thing for you to understand is the market order. That is telling your brokerage firm, I want to buy at the best price available now. Don't play any games. Go buy or go sell now. The others, a little tricky, so please go through those and read them carefully. And as I said, I normally use and recommend market orders. Short-term traders tell me they prefer limit orders or stop orders on all their trades. Why? Because they only want to lose a certain amount of money. So they think this stock is at 25. They think it's going to go to 30. But they'll set a stop loss at 23. So that if it falls to 23, boom, it sells. So they haven't lost. Now that's the wrong way of thinking, in my humble opinion. And remember, everybody's different. That's why there's chocolate and vanilla, and some people like strawberry. Because if it's a stock that you want and the price goes down, that's a great time to buy more, isn't it? Not according to the traders. No. They want to kick out, stop out, it's often called. They were stopped out to protect against losses. The problem with that is that you're locking in the loss. And folks, if you get somebody on the other side, the two of us could argue for hours about the benefits and disadvantages of both. So just understand that my humble opinion, market orders are the way to go, but you're going to hear differently from other different people. Slide 37. At the end of the semester, we will spend a week on buying on margin and selling short. For now, all you need to know is what is on this slide, because they're tricky. Buying on margin allows you to borrow money from your broker to enhance your return. Huh? Yes, instead of putting up 100%, you can borrow up to 50% of the purchase price, and that can magnify your return. But it can also magnify your loss, as we will discuss in detail at the end of the semester. Selling short is even trickier. This is borrowing stock and selling it in the hopes that the price will go down. You sell stock that you don't own, you borrow it, huh? That doesn't sound right. Well, you must buy it back at some time in the future. So many people believe that you can only make money when the market goes up. Selling short allows you to make money when the market or a single stock goes down. Chapter 2 spends a whole lot of time on margins and selling short. And as I said, that's the wrong way, in my humble opinion, to introduce somebody to investments. We will discuss these in detail late in the semester. My advice to you is to never sell short. It is simply too risky. And Peter Lynch, excuse me, says that you should not sell short. And who am I to argue with Peter Lynch? Using a margin account can be useful once you have built a substantial portfolio. It allows you to borrow from your portfolio without selling your stocks. Again, all you need to know about buying on margin, selling short, is what's on this slide. Transaction costs. Traditionally, transaction costs were in the 1% to 5% range, sometimes higher, and the largest percentage of the cost was the brokerage's commission. But deep discount internet brokers have driven the commissions to down as low as $5 per trade. A few firms used to offer free trades. Wait a minute, how can they make any money doing that? That doesn't make any sense. But have transaction costs really gone down? The answer is yes, they have, but more and more the cost is hidden from the investor, especially the internet garbage brokers. Now, folks, those aren't my words. I was working at the first brokerage firm I worked at, And one of the clients, that's what they called them, the internet garbage brokers. And I thought, okay, that's an interesting saying. He obviously did not trust them. Slide number 39. A deep discount broker offers trades for $7. In the fine print of the client broker agreement is included a provision for allowing the broker to solely utilize exclusive stock dealers and market makers. Remember, as we said in the previous presentation, the quoted price is simply the best price available. But at any one time, there are dozens of prices quoted as dealers and market makers and what used to be called specialists compete for buy and sell orders. Take a look at the Casas de Cambio presentation. The chosen dealer, the exclusive dealer, doesn't necessarily have the best price. Instead of paying, say, $20, the investor might pay $20.05. Now, the investor sees the $7 commission on their confirmation, but the investor does not see the extra, for example, $5 that they paid on a 100-share purchase because of the dealer's markup. Do you understand? They wound up actually paying $12, which is still very cheap by historical standards. This, on slide 40, is the disclaimer that used to be, I think it still is, but I haven't checked. This disclaimer is included, or at least used to be, in each trade confirmation email from Scottrade, one of the deep discount internet brokers that charges, still I think, $7 a trade. And notice it's all uppercase. And that's supposed to make it important. But they're not stupid. They know that all uppercase is harder to read. So when they're trying to show you something that's important, but they don't want you to read it, they use all uppercase. And you can't understand it even if you do read it. Let's see if we can follow this. Scottrade Incorporated receives remuneration for directing orders to particular broker dealers or market centers for execution. Such remuneration is considered compensation to the firm, and the source and amount of any compensation received by the firm in connection with your transaction will be disclosed upon request. Amen. What is this? It doesn't it sound like Gregorian chat? That's, I just, every time I see it, I just think, what are you, goofballs? What are they telling you? What is remuneration? That's another fancy word for money. In other words, what's happening is they're getting a kickback. Oh, that's such an ugly word. The particular broker-dealer that they are using is kicking back some of the markup or markdown, depending on whether it's a buy or sell order, back to Scottrade. And that's how they make more than $7 a trade. And in Scottrade's defense, at least they prominently disclose this relationship on every email confirmation that you receive. Not that anybody ever reads it. Many others hide it in their customer agreement fine print, and the customers are never aware of the relationship. Slide 41. You think that the Securities and Exchange Commission would not be too happy about this, right? It doesn't sound like it's in the best interest of the clients. So what the Securities and Exchange Commission says is that your broker has the duty to seek the best execution that is reasonably available for its customers' orders. But that's not a guarantee. The Securities and Exchange Commission requires broker-dealers to notify their customers if the orders are not routed for best execution. Typically, this disclosure is on the trade confirmation slip you receive after placing your order. And this was taken from an article at Investopedia. And determining whether or not a customer got best execution can be very difficult. And this next link is an example of the Securities and Exchange Commission trying, but not doing a very good job, to enforce the rules. Indeed, the Securities and Exchange Commission is looking into making the cost more transparent, possibly showing the customer the difference between the dealer's price and the best price available at the time of transaction. maybe even gasp, showing the total cost of the transaction from the markup or the markdown. Needless to say, the deep discount brokers cried, "It would drive up the cost of commissions and ultimately hurt the consumer." What a crock of... And the proposal died. So it is up to you, dear investors, to check if you're getting the best execution. But how can you... excuse me. How can you, a loan investor, determine if you're getting the best price, if even the Securities and Exchange Commission has trouble watching over the brokerage companies? And the answer is you can't, unless you specifically ask your brokerage account, "Do you give me the best execution?" And you're going to, the first person you talk to is going to go, "Wow, I don't know what you're talking about." And you're going to go up the chain of command, and they'll say, "Well, we're supposed to do that." And yeah, we know you're supposed to do it, but do you? Look in the client, the customer broker agreement, the client brokerage agreement. See if you find verbiage on that, along those lines. Now, the full service and the discount brokers typically will give you best execution. The internet brokers typically won't. So you have to be careful. And we'll discuss these at the end of the semester in more detail. But the one I found that gives probably the best price and requires best execution is Schwab. So there you go. There's a bit of a plug for the competition. Okay. Slide 43. Round lots versus odd lots. Now this distinction is not as important as it used to be because of technology. It used to be that brokers wanted you to buy in 100 share increments. That was called a round lot. And that was because it just made it easier to buy and sell the shares on the floor of the exchange. Because if a broker held out their hand and pushed it away from them and said 25, all the other brokers knew that they were willing to sell because they pushed it away from themselves. They pushed their hand away from themselves, 100 shares at $25 a share. If they said 2 at 25, that was 200 shares at $25 a share. If they moved their hand toward themselves, that was a buy order. Folks, those days are gone. Right? Those days are gone. Everything's typed into the computer. You see why they wanted 100 round lots, the 100 shares, round lots? Because it just made it faster. Because if they wanted to sell 17 shares or 87 shares, they had to say 87 shares at 25 and push their hand away from themselves or toward themselves, depending on whether it was a sell or a buy order. So what they used to do is they would hit you with an odd lot differential, which was typically 12.5 to 25 cents more if you were buying, and then 12.5 to 25% less if you were selling. Now it's typically less than 5 cents. Some people recommend against odd lot purchases because of the higher cost. Folks, you're talking pennies. On 10 shares, 50 cents. Maybe, you know, 10 cents if it's only a penny. Maybe a buck. On 80 shares, maybe it's $2 or $3. Big deal. Don't worry about it. You want to buy 17 shares of FedEx, go buy 17 shares of FedEx. This is an anachronism. You know what that means? It's from something from the past. But you still should know it. You should know that a round lot is a 100 share or multiple of 100 shares, and anything less than 100 shares is an odd lot. Slide 44, reading stock quotes. Well, we're going to discuss these numbers in more detail as we go along, but different sources will contain some, all, or more of these statistics. But always remember that the quoted price that you're looking at, if you're looking at it on the internet, is the best price, but there are many others available. Plus, you are watching the prices 15, 20 minutes ago. Unless you pay extra or happen to be at your brokerage office, you're seeing the delayed price, not the current price. Interesting, right? Yeah, you got to pay extra for that. Slide 45. Here is the Wall Street Journal's statistics that they publish every day. And all the other newspapers have given it up. They don't do it anymore because they know people don't look at the newspaper anymore for the stock quotes. Oh my God, you mean you actually wait until the next day to find out how much your stock is worth? How 20th century. And other profs say, why don't you require your students to buy the Wall Street Journal? And I say, because it's not as important as it used to be. It used to be the Bible. But there are just so many other good sources, and I don't even think it's that great anymore. It got purchased by Rupert Murdoch's Fox News, and we all know how unbiased they are. So I don't even trust them that much. But that's up to you. You decide whether you want to live and die by the Wall Street Journal. Slide 46. What most people now use is the InfernoNet. And the best site used to be Yahoo. Their finance site used to be awesome. And they've literally destroyed it. After destroying their homepage and their email. And I don't understand why people still use Yahoo. But I gotta say that their individual stock pages are still the best. Other people like Bloomberg, MarketWatch, which is owned by the Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal, you have to pay. MarketWatch is their free site. And that's actually not too bad. Morningstar, CNBC, there are a lot of them out there. But I still like Yahoo for looking up individual stocks as a starting point. So there will be an accompanying presentation on how to use Yahoo to do your research. In the face-to-face class, we would now jump over to Yahoo and I would show people how to use it. But don't think you have to use that. There are many out there to do your research. Slide 47. All right. Finally. Where are we? Chapter 5? You know, 7th, 6th, 5th, 6th, 7th week? 5th week, 6th week? Finally, we're going to cover market averages, market indexes, benchmarks in detail. Slide 47. How can we say that stocks have returned approximately 10%, it's actually a little more, over the past 70 years? Well, the industry uses market averages and indexes, benchmarks. And I don't know if you like that term or not, but it's a measurement. It's a standard that is used to measure the general behavior of securities prices, in this case stocks, by reflecting either the average price behavior, that's a market average, or the relational price behavior, that's a market index, of representative groups of securities, in this case stocks, at any given point in time. And folks, you cannot help but hear about these every day. The Dow went down, the NASDAQ went up. And there is a difference between a market average and a market index, and the book describes it in detail, but most people don't know the difference. They don't even know there is a difference. And for you and me, it's not important. Okay, so when we say average, when we say index, we mean basically the same thing. Most all of them are indexes. Slide 48. This slide is trying to show you the difference between the two. Market averages look solely at the price of the stock without regard to the market value. And the most popular example of this is the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Market-weighted calculations, market indexes, use the stock price, but then multiply that times the number of shares outstanding. And what we're going to find out is that's what's called market capitalization. In other words, it takes into account the market value of the stock in the index. So not only does it look at the price, it looks to see how large the company is, or small. And the larger the company, the more influence the security will have in the index. In this case, we're talking about stocks, but it could be other securities, such as bonds. And the most popular of this one is the Standard & Poor's 500, and also the NASDAQ composite is also very popular. Market-weighted calculations were generally regarded as a better measure until the bubble of the late 1990s, which skewed things out of proportion, and they showed, well, you know, nothing's perfect, and neither are market-weighted indices. So let us take a look, dear students, at the hallowed, sacred Dow Jones Industrial Average that I wish they would just get rid of, because it has long passed its usefulness. They should have gotten rid of it 20, 30 years ago. It only consists of 30 stocks, and they're based here in the United States. They are selected for total market value and broad public ownership and believed to reflect overall market activity, and they don't do a very good job of it. They use share price calculations, and wouldn't you know it, it's the most famous and the one that everybody quotes, and it's the worst one out there. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, the Dow Average. It changes from time to time as companies and industries evolve, and as such, it now has more non-industrial stocks than industrial stocks. You would think they would have just gotten rid of the word industrial at the very least. Dow Jones is the company that publishes the Wall Street Journal. In 2007, Rupert Murdoch of Fox News fame, his company is actually called News Corp and they're based in Australia, purchased it for about $2 billion more than everyone thought it was worth. People thought that the Dow Jones company was worth about $3 billion, and the Bancroft family, going back to the late 1800s when Charles Dow created the Dow Jones Industrial Average in 1896, the Bancroft family still owned it, and they didn't want to sell. And some of them still didn't want to sell, even though they offered them $2 billion more than it was worth. And the other family members said, look, come on, we're not going to get any kind of better deal than this. After they bought it, Rupert Murdoch made noises about getting rid of the industrial average. You just heard it quickly, and you didn't hear anything else after that. That was several years ago. And now it appears that they sold it and all their other indices to Standard & Poor's, their major competitor in the index market. It appears to be, but I'm not sure. If you can figure it out, dear students, I would certainly love to hear what you think they've done with it, because it looks as though Standard & Poor's is now in control of the Dow Jones Industrial Average and all the other indices that they created. Curiouser and curiouser. Slide 50. Here they are, folks. The 30 Dow Jones Industrial Average stocks. And most all these companies, you know who they are. Maybe a couple you don't. Who? American Excuse, AT&T Party, Boeing. What does Boeing make? Yeah, they make planes and jets and defense. They're a big dense defense contractor. Caterpillar, right, tractors. Chevron Oil, Cisco is the networking company, Coke, Disney, DuPont, a chemical company, Exxon, or an oil company, General Electric, the only stock that has been in the Dow since 1896, Goldman Sachs, an investment bank, not like a regular bank that you go to, folks, no, it's a, they do God's work, as according to Lloyd Blankfeldt. Home Depot, IBM, Intel, Johnson & Johnson, J.P. Morgan Chase. Now, they're a bank, but they're more than just a bank. McDonald's, Merck is a drug company. Microsoft, Nike, Pfizer, another drug company. Procter & Gamble, who are they? Tide, Gillette, Pampers, yeah, consumer products. 3M, Minnesota Mining and Materials, Scotch Tape, Post-it Notes. And they make 10,000 or 100,000 other different types of materials, most all of which are flat. Travelers is an insurance company, United Healthcare Insurance. United Technologies is actually a really an industrial company. They make Otis elevators and helicopters and Pratt & Whitney jet engines, Verizon, Visa, and Walmart. So most all these companies have nothing to do with industrial, but that they've kept the name. And on the website, in the face-to-face class now, we would do a little exercise to show how well these companies have done over the last 80 some odd years. And it's a bit of an eye-opener. And what the people will say is, the dollar is basically where it was 10 years ago or whatever. But the truth is, no, it's not. Because they keep diddling with it. They kick out some companies, they put in other companies, and often they kick out a company just in time for that company to come back. They think it's an old... Sometimes they don't come back, such as Woolworths. But other times they kick them out just in time for them to come back, and they put somebody else in just in time for them to fall down. They put Intel and Microsoft into the Dow in 1999, I think, just in the year before the tech bubble started to burst, right? And Microsoft didn't return to its 1999 high until 2013 or something like that. Indeed. And then what's missing is American International Group, AIG, and General Motors, who both of which went through bankruptcy in the 2008 debacle. So it's meaningless. The Dow is meaningless. Trying to come up with a long-term average using the Dow is a very difficult argument to make. But that doesn't stop people from listening to it and how it's doing every day. Oh, well. So go ahead and do that exercise called 81 years ago. And don't peek at the answers, okay? Slide number 51. But given that it's the one that everyone uses out there, what we can go back in time and see is that there are large periods of time when these indices really don't do a whole lot. They sort of look like they stand still. But that's not true. They didn't really stand still. They're bouncing around the whole time. But you see, between 1906 and 1924, it started at 100 and then wound up at 100. But in that time, there were a couple of serious crashes and other times when it rose. And then between 1924 and 1929, it rose three times within 5 years. And then the big Great Depression came, and it took 25 years for the Dow Jones Industrial Average to recover. The stocks in the Dow Jones Industrial Average went down 89%, 88.5%, not quite 90%. Yeah, right, between 1929 and the depths of this recession at 1932. And that's why for two generations people were, I don't want to have anything to do with stocks. And then we see between 1954 and 1966, the Dow rose again three times. But then another 16-year period, where it hit 1,000, fell back, hit 1,000, fell back. And finally, 1982, we see the dramatic rise. The dramatic rise where it just went in two directions, up and way up. And then again, there was the lost decade. So there are going to be times when these indices, and of course we said that the Dow is not the best measure, but not just the Dow, there are going to be times when these markets don't advance. So, as an investor, what do you do? How do you make money in stocks during times when the markets and the capital gains are flat? The answer, again, depends upon whether you're an investor or a speculator or a trader. If you're a speculator trader, you basically have to try to guess when it's going to fall, guess when it's going to go back up, guess when it's going to fall again, and buy and sell and buy and sell. And all I can say is good luck, because you're going to need it. But if you're an investor, you simply continue to buy high-quality companies at reasonable prices, and when the market falls, great. The next month, the next whatever time you put more money in, you're going to get more shares at a better price. And then when the market goes up, you're going to buy fewer shares. Dollar cost averaging. Pretty boring, isn't it? Sounds really boring. In the investment world, boring is good. in my humble opinion. But remember that you are going to hear otherwise from other people in the industry. And everyone's entitled to their own opinion, especially if it's mine, right? No. It's a joke. It's worked for me. But you decide. Slide 52. Dow Jones has other averages and indexes, most of which you don't hear too much about. The transportation average, though, you will sometimes hear people discuss that because they use it as a leading indicator of the economy in general. If the Dow Jones transportation average is going up, that's supposed to be a good sign for the economy, because before the stuff can be made and purchased, it's got to get to the place where they make it, it's got to get to the place where they sell it. The utilities average is pretty boring, because utilities are pretty boring. You put the industrial, the transportation, and the utilities average together, and that's called the Dow Jones 65 composite average that nobody ever hears about. But these next two are very important. Why? Because index funds based on these are most likely going to show up in your 401k or 403b. And when you did the TSP, does this look familiar? Right, exactly. See, the Wilshire 5000 was started by a company, Wilshire Associates, and they're based in LA. And then Dow Jones, I'm not exactly sure how they did it, but they added their name. They must have paid them something or something. And then they kicked them to the side. So figure that one out. The 5,000 companies representing large companies, medium-sized companies, and small companies. And then what Wilshire did was brilliant. They took those 5,000 and pulled out the top 500 stocks. Those are the stocks in the Standard & Poor's 500. And so that is a very popular index because it shows us how the medium-sized companies and the small companies are doing. And as you saw, it's one of the indices that is used in the Thrift Savings Plan. The Dow Jones Internet Index is a very good example of what happens when people lose track of their senses. They introduced the Dow Jones Internet Index at the height of the internet tech bubble in the late 1990s and watched it fall 96%. Yeah, don't follow fads. Slide number 53. Okay, folks, here it is. How many times have we said Standard & Poor's 500, S&P 500? How many times have we used it? Now we're finally getting to it? This is the problem with putting mutual funds before stocks, but we even discussed it back in Chapter 1. The Standard & Poor's 500 Composite Index, the S&P 500, the S&P, are 500 stocks chosen for market size, liquidity, and industry group representation. It, along with all the others we're going to look at, is a market value weighted index, not just share price like the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Traditionally, it contained the 500 largest companies based in the United States, but it now can contain some foreign stocks. And why is that? Well, it has to do with what started happening with globalization and the like through the 1980s and 90s, because companies from across the pond and both ponds started to buy one another. And ARCO and Amoco, which you probably never heard of, but that's a company based, I think, in Ohio or somewhere in the Midwest. They are oil companies that were purchased by British Petroleum. But British Petroleum is based in the UK. And then Daimler-Benz, Mercedes-Benz, bought Chrysler. Wait a minute. Chrysler was one of the biggest companies in the United States. So Standard & Poor's said, okay, we'll let these foreign companies that now own very large United States companies to be in the Standard & Poor's 500. It is a very popular index, as we've seen, because it is used by many, many index funds. Although, in my humble opinion, it's lost some of its original focus. What you will find is most all of these large companies are no longer United States companies, folks. They are global companies. So if it were up to me, which is not, I would re-finagle the Standard & Poor's 500 and turn it more global. But I don't think that's ever going to happen. But that's me. That's just me. Because the Standard & Poor's 500 index is market-weighted, it was affected by the tech bubble of the late 1990s in a bizarre manner. The market values of a small percentage of technology companies were inflated to extremes. AOL, which eventually bought Time Warner, Amazon, which is still around, eBay, which is still around, many of others are nowhere near to be found, CMGI, who are they, eToys, Pets.com, DrCoop.com, yeah, all these companies which are gone, and a handful of companies reached unbelievable heights, such as Microsoft and Cisco and Oracle. And what happens is because the market-weighted index counts companies that are larger with more weight, right? They get more influence. It skewed. You like that word, skewed? It means pushed it out of proportion. Because the index funds would have to buy more of the company because the company is representing more of the index. So it became literally a bubble. As the company's price went up, the index funds were required. They had no choice. They couldn't say, this is ridiculous. These valuations are insane. We're going to buy fewer stocks. No, they have to. They're required. This is why I'm not a big fan of index funds, folks, personally. And consequently, in 1998, 10% of the gain in the Standard & Poor's 500 was due to just one stock, and that was Microsoft. So you see, nothing is perfect. Don't let anybody tell you that index funds are perfect. They have their same, they have advantages, and they have disadvantages. Every investment has advantages and disadvantages. Make sense? Makes sense. Okay. Enough said. Of course. Let me just add one more point. They pumped up the bubble. Right. And sure enough, the bubble deflated when the prices, people started realizing these prices are insane. And then what does the index fund have to do? They must sell. They can't make any judgment calls. And decades ago, Benjamin Graham warned against any system of investing that removes an investor's judgment out of the picture. So another thing to think about, folks, when people tell you that index funds are the only way to invest, you just say, yeah, sure, okay. Because you're not going to convince them otherwise. They'll just think you're a shill for the industry if you try to say, well, there's something, there's some problems with them. No, they'll think you work for a brokerage firm or a mutual fund company. Slide 54. Standard & Poor's also has many other indexes, most of which you really don't hear that much about: the Industrial 400, the Mid-Cap 400, the Small-Cap 600. Add the S&P 500 plus the Mid-Cap 400 and the Small-Cap and you get the 1500. And then there are transportation, utilities, financials, globals, internationals, sector indices. Go to their website and just look at the dozens and dozens of different indices. Yeah. Now, the New York Stock Exchange and the Amex, which is now called the NYSE MICIT Market Composite, and the NASDAQ, they all have their own indices. But the one you're going to hear the most about is the NASDAQ. Because the NASDAQ composite represents the technology sector of the economy. Now remember that some of the companies on the NASDAQ are not technology companies per se, so to speak. Starbucks, is that a technology company? Costco. But many of them are. So people will use the NASDAQ as a proxy, as a way to measure what's going on with the technology sector. And it's very telling. Between 1995 and 2000, the NASDAQ went from 800 to 5,000. March of 2000, it started to fall, and it dropped 80% by the time it started to recover in 2003. Ouch. Slide 56. There are a few other indices on the next two slides that I want you to memorize, and I'll explain this in more detail in just a couple of slides, so just relax. We already made mention of the total and extended stock market indices. They used to be called the Wilshire 5000, then it was the Dow Jones Wilshire 5000, and now it's the Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market Index, which I'm sure everybody says trippingly on the tongue and can never forget. Standard & Poor's has their own Total Stock Market Index, and MSCI, next slide, they have their U.S. Broad Market. They don't want to use total, so they use broad. And then we discussed the Wilshire 4500, which then became the Dow Jones Wilshire 4500, and then became the Dow Jones U.S. Completion Stock Market Index, which was used, or is used, in this Thrift Savings Plan. Standard & Poor's has their own completion index, but interestingly enough, MSCI doesn't. And then the last slide for our indices are three more indices that you should learn. And before we continue, just look at the bottom of the slide. You see stock worksheet number one? That's what I want you to key on. There are seven or eight indices that you should know by name. So you don't have to memorize all of these that are in the presentation. Just the ones that are on that stock worksheet. And after we would finish this slide in the face-to-face class, we would do that worksheet. So you go and do that worksheet after you're done here. Russell 2000 is an index that you may hear a little bit about. It is meant to measure small company performance. How did they do that? Well, they took the top 1,000 companies and then took the top 3,000 companies. And then they removed the top 1,000 companies from the top 3,000 companies. You see, they cut off the top. So they have companies 1,001 through 3,000. So that's meant to measure small company performance. It doesn't get a whole lot of press, but savvy pundits and investors will watch how the small companies are doing, because when the small companies start doing well, that's usually the time we're coming out of a recession, because they got hammered so hard when we went into the recession. So they will watch the Russell to see if we're coming out of a difficult time. And then for decades, there were really no measures of what was going on outside the United States or with the world in general. The company that does this, now the others do it too now, but for decades, since about the late 70s, early 80s, is Morgan Stanley Capital International. Now, I don't care if you remember what MSCI stands for. It has an interesting history. Capital is the real name of the American funds, but nobody knows that unless you work in the industry. And they were one, even though they're called the American funds, they were one of the first companies that invested outside the United States. There were others, but they were one of the first ones. And they didn't have a way to measure how they were doing. So they started their own index for global, and that's the world index, and they started one for international. That's the EAFE, stands for Europe, Australia, and the Far East. But wait a minute. You're creating the index that you're measuring yourself against. Do you see the conflict of interest here that American funds had, that Capital had? And so what they did is they spun off the indices to Morgan Stanley, and Morgan Stanley kept the name Capital International, Morgan Stanley Capital International. Now, you're going to probably forget that, but I think it's an interesting story. It shows that yes, some people do have integrity in the industry, don't they? They thought, you know, this is not a good idea for us to be measuring ourselves, because, of course, exactly, you're going to make yourself look really, really good. Now, what's happened in the intervening years is that the world has changed. The World Index included companies in the developed world, United States, Canada, Western Europe, Hong Kong, Australia, Japan, Singapore. Instead of just changing the World Index, as the developing world countries got bigger and bigger and bigger, they are replacing the World Index with the MSCI All Country World Index. Now, what a dumb name. They didn't ask me. I wouldn't. I just would have changed the World Index, but they didn't ask me. And the same thing is true with the IFA. They're now changing that to include the developing countries, and it is called the MSCI All Country World Ex-USA Index. Dumb. But, oh, by the way, when you were doing the thrift savings plan, right, check to see which one was the I fund, the international fund. Which index is the international fund in the thrift savings plan using? So, as I said, you're going to want to do the stock worksheet number one that will help you with these indices. The indices I want you to know by name, so that if somebody said the name, you could describe it, or if somebody described it, you could say the name. There's a answer key and a commentary. Slide 58. Every day when you go on the Infernal Net or watch the news, which I don't know if you've noticed, but the studies have shown that people who watch television news have greater anxiety in their life than people who read and don't watch television news. Just want to let you know. So here we have the graph that you're going to see every day. You're going to see this graph where the stock market zoomed up in the morning and then fell crashing down in the afternoon, only to come back and basically end pretty much where it started from. Why? Because they have to sell newspapers. They have to sell advertising. They have to sell eyeballs. We call this stock market index mania! But what are they doing here? You mathematicians, you students of statistics, will know that they are cutting off almost all of the index and just showing you a very small piece of it. What if they were to include the entire index? We would have a graph that looks something like this that nobody would want to look at, but that's what they really should show. And we call this stock market index ennui. You know what ennui, it's a French word, but it's in the English language. It means beyond boredom. Are you going to see this graph on the nightly news? No. And what we can do now is come back to our volatility and re-examine it. In the previous presentation, we took a look at $10,000 bouncing up and down throughout the year 2014. But if we include the entire portion of the graph from 0 to 10,000 and take a look at the graph, it's nowhere near as exciting, is it? Yeah, it just... Volatility is something you learn to live with. And if you keep a long-term perspective, you should not be frightened by it. You should just expect it and take advantage of it. And in the face-to-face class, I would show a little video right now. I can't... It's copyrighted, so I can't put it up on my website. So that talks about, is an interview with a guy who's been in the business for over 40 years. And he's asked about volatility. He laughs, basically. He said, that's just an opportunity to buy companies that I've been wanting to buy but were too expensive, and now they've gotten cheaper, so I buy them. So he, and hopefully you, welcome the volatility. Assuming you have a long-term perspective, exactly. If you need this money next week, you don't want it in the stock market, folks, because it dropped 20% in one day. It's done it before. It'll do it again. you will not see this graph on the nightly news or on the InfernalNet. Right, exactly. So, is it starting to come together, folks? Go back over, make sure you understand the transactions, make sure you understand the indices, the ones I want you to know. And in our next presentation, we will take a look at even more characteristics about stocks, and specifically, we'll discuss dividends, because we love dividends. See you in our next presentation.